25, and, do we want to deal with the, do we have the bonus, do the presentation, or would you want to do the...
Yeah, why don't we have them come up and do their presentation?
Yeah, Bill, come on up. I'm just trying to get the order and such wired together here.
Ready for me?
You bet, sir.
For the record, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Association, I'm the Director of Government Relations. With me is, Mike Mills from Mills and McMillan, an attorney firm here in Salem, my certified smart person for technical questions. I gave you a packet which includes our issue paper, a list of, Mr. Mills's analysis of the two cases in question, a list of the cases, and a Oregonian article from July 28th after the Fulmer case, as it would say, came down, in Coos Bay. And what we are searching for in this bill is to try to bring us back to where we as an industry felt case law was, at the end of last session. The Fulmer case, as it's termed, is a position where a gentleman came into a bar, got intoxicated, and on his way exiting the bar hurt himself as he fell down a staircase. Both the lower court and the appeals court threw the case out. The Supreme Court has remanded it back down to the district court for a jury trial, and to our knowledge, nothing has been done with it since that point. What we're asking for in the bill is just simply to restate what we feel the two lower courts said was, if you drink, become intoxicated on your own accord and hurt yourself, that you cannot seek damages from the licensee. There is also an amendment, a dash one amendment, I don't know if you have, that the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association has presented. They had a concern with, this bill may have expanded it to property damages. So if the stair was broken and he fell, that you could not sue under that circumstance. I would say that was never our intent under the bill. And so as we view the amendment, we would be, happy with the amendment if the committee saw fit. We have no problems with it. We were also presented with a second amendment that legislative council brought forward, and as far as we can tell, that does not seem to be any problems, from our perspective either. With that, I don't know if you have any questions, or would you like to add anything, or...
I don't think so. Mr. Mills?
I don't have anything to add, and Mr. Perry, please, thank you. Thank you on the floor.
Anybody have any questions? No questions, okay. Dave Hendricks, will you want to come up and share, are you the author of the amendments?
Chairman, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Deputy Legislative Council, author. The, dash one amendment that you have, which apparently came from the Trial Lawyers Association, basically are just addressed, as Mr. Perry indicated, towards making sure that, the only thing that the amendment, did was to reinstate the limitation on liability by reason of, injuries you suffered by reason of your own intoxication, and not to take out, the scenario where in fact there was, defective stairs or failure to light or some of the other things that can occur, so that if you have a claim based on that, these amendments to the Dram Shop Act won't limit that liability. The second, hand and gross ones that, committee council have given you were some things we talked about this morning, where, in looking at the language of the bill, printed in a couple of months after I did it during the, rush of the deadline, it occurred to me that perhaps it would be better to make it clear that this law, that this change to the law, would in fact not allow suits under theories, not only for common law negligence, which is what is specified in the bill, but also under any theory, and that was the intent of the changes that, the council had given you.
All right. Any other questions? Everybody clear on what we're doing?
And you don't have, I'll have to apologize, I did not give you, although I can,
Why don't you just read it, it's fairly simple, so feel free to read it.
If you look at the bill on line seven, starting in the middle, it says, that the person does not have a cause of action, it would insert comma, based on statute or common law, comma, against the person serving the alcoholic beverages. Then it would delete the based on common law negligence in line eight. Again, I'm reading off of the bill, not off of the amendment.
Now, we have a dash one, Mr. Chairman, too, right?
That's correct. And the dash one amendments are to limit it to the purpose that the proponents of the bill originally introduced it for, which was to restrict it to the negligence that arises out of someone's own intoxication.
Would you like to, we're not
in work session.
We're not in work session.
But you're most ahead of me.
Well, I'm trying to catch up for when I have to wait for.
Okay, work session, Senate Bill 925.
Mr. Chair, I move dash one amendments to Senate Bill 925.
Senator Duncan moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 925. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Courtney?
Don't you have more that you want to do?
Well, right now, all we have is a conceptual amendment.
Well, but we've done, you going to do that again?
Yes, Senator Courtney moves that we suspend the rules for purpose of adopting a handwritten amendment to Senate Bill 925. Any objection? Hearing none? So ordered.
Chair, on line seven, page one of Senate Bill 921, as amended by dash one amendments, I would offer the following conception amendment, following the word action, insert a comma, add the word based on statute or common law. That is the conceptual amendment that I place before the committee.
And on line eight.
Well, so you didn't know that, would
it? It's deletion.
Oh. On line eight, what do you want to leave after beverage? No.
The beverages, delete the words based on common law negligence.
Based on. After the word beverages, the word based on common law negligence. No, it's got to be more than that.
Sounds a lot easier when you.
Yeah, that's all right. That's.
Henrix, where are you?
That's fine, I think.
What?
Well, he's not any help.
Well, I think that's it, because then it says beverages, even though the election. So the words based on common law language would come out, right?
That's correct.
That's correct.
So, okay. I wish he'd stayed here, but I think that's what you wanted to do. That's the amendment.
Okay, so Senator Courtney moves that we amend the currently amended Senate Bill 925, previously amended by dash one amendments, so that on line seven, after the word action, we're inserting a comma and the words based on statute or common law. Then on line eight, after the word beverages, we're deleting the words based on common law negligence. And for the record, is that correct?
You didn't mention this comma.
Oh, and sorry, one other comma after the word common law. So it would read, for the record, a patron or guest who voluntarily consumes alcoholic beverages served by a person licensed by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, comma, a person holding a permit issued by the commission or a social host does not have a cause of action, comma, based on statute or common law against the person serving the alcoholic, against the person serving the alcoholic beverages, even though the alcoholic beverages are served to the patron or guest while the patron or guest is visibly intoxicated. Clear enough? Any objections? Clear enough. Sorry. Senator Courtney.
I move this.
You're going to have to carry it, then.
Senate Bill 921 is amended to go to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Courtney moves that Senate Bill 925 is amended by the dash one amendments and in this committee. Go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Anybody want to carry this?
G. your bill.
I'll carry it. I will carry this bill. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And thank you, trial lawyers. Appreciate your help. Next up. Senate Bill 667. And Brian Ostrom, Oregon State Police. Oh, are you?
I'm Brian Ostrom with the State Police Crime Lab, but I'm here to testify on 920.
Are you the proponent?
Yes.
You're Mr. Mr. Wynn.
That's right.
All right, we're getting our act together. If you want to have a seat.
I can see that. You're very well organized here.
Are we?
Yes, you are. Fooled another one, huh, Mr. Chair?
Well, at least we're giving the appearance that we know what we're doing.
I did bring some written testimony. Would that be appropriate?
You want to get a request on that restroom, Dale?
Ingrid, you've actually signed up in favor of a bill. Good one. Bill, go right ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, 925.
By way of introduction, let me begin with my name.
You need to state your name for the record, if you would.
Yes, for the record, my name is Bill Winner. I am a professor at Oregon State University, and I'm author and proponent of Senate Bill 667, that would provide post-conviction relief that can for those who can prove innocence or justify sentence reduction with DNA forensic evidence. It's important to know that my interest in this bill is that of a private concerned citizen. I'm not a defense attorney, not a prosecuting attorney, not a member of the state police. I've never been associated with a citizen action group that would take a position on death penalty or DNA testing. I've never been convicted of any crimes. I have no personal axe to grind with this measure. None of my family have been incarcerated for any measure that could be at all related to this bill. All of my educational degrees are in biology. I'm a professor in the Department of Botany and Plant Pathology at Oregon State University, and I'm director of the OSU Environmental Sciences Graduate Program. My thinking about Senate Bill 667 stems from conversations with many individuals, though, including private citizens, lawyers in Oregon, and members of the Oregon legislature. There are many examples that show DNA testing can answer all kinds of interesting and important biological questions, and this is really where my interest in this bill was first born. DNA evidence was used, for example, to learn more about the biological relationships between ancient primates, the Neanderthals, and modern peoples. It's also been used to show that humans that we know today evolved from an ancestral Eve, a single group of people in Africa. DNA evidence has also shown the identity of King Tut, as used to establish that Thomas Jefferson fathered a son by a slave, and that O.J. Simpson was indeed present at the murder of his wife and her friend. A common application of DNA technology is to solve and resolve paternity suits, but the utility and the applications of DNA testing have developed rapidly, especially over the last few years, largely because of two reasons. First, the concerns about the accuracy of the testing are now pretty much diminished, and secondly, because the amount of the biological sample needed to obtain a DNA analysis has become progressively smaller. So as a result, DNA testing is becoming more important in all realms of science and also in the judicial system. One of the most important applications of DNA testing, therefore, involves
those who are still alive and who have been convicted of serious crimes. The truth of the matter is actually that only a very small fraction of those convicted of a serious crime are really innocent, and even a smaller fraction of those who are innocent can prove so using DNA testing. However, even a small fraction of those convicted of serious crimes actually results in a fairly large number of individuals across the nation. With DNA testing, there's little possibility that a guilty convict could use DNA testing unfairly to find innocence or to achieve a reduction in their sentence. So DNA testing cannot really be used to establish innocence if innocence does not exist. The existence of innocent convicts is not typically caused by errors in the current judicial system, and I think this is an important issue. The reason that we have innocent people incarcerated now is not necessarily because of errors in the judicial system. It's important to recognize that people who are convicted are largely in that situation because of the weight of the evidence used at the time of the trial. And what Senate Bill 667 does is simply improve the quality of evidence that can be used to establish innocence for those who are now convicted. So we just want to improve the quality of evidence that people have available for making decisions about guilt. Let me give you a few examples of how DNA evidence has made a difference. Last year, for example, Governor George Ryan of Illinois imposed a moratorium on executions after 13 inmates, one coming within 2 days of execution, were proven innocent. Between 1973, when the death penalty was reinstated, and the year 2000, 87 death row inmates have been released from prison. Of those releases, 73 post-conviction remedies were based on DNA evidence. Interestingly, DNA is often used as evidence in current pretrial actions, and DNA samples from suspects in sex crimes and murders are routinely used now. Of the first 18,000 such DNA tests nationwide, 26% of these tests were suspects were found to be innocent. These data suggest several things. First, that the main use of DNA testing is really by prosecuting attorneys. Secondly, that initial suspects are often innocent. And thirdly, and perhaps the target of this bill, is that many of the innocent convicts that we have in jail today could be remedied by DNA testing now. So now is the time to be sure, at least as sure as possible, that Oregon joins the growing ranks of states that allow post-conviction relief when DNA evidence shows innocence. There are three specific examples that are fairly well known among the community interested in this topic. One is Rick McGinn, who was imprisoned in Texas, and this involved a case that is well documented in Newsweek and Time magazines. Rick McGinn was scheduled for execution in Huntsville, Texas in June of 2000, coincidentally during the presidential campaigns, for a 1993 murder and rape of his 12-year-old stepdaughter. He received poor legal advice, but finally found a way to have DNA evidence introduced on his behalf. And Texas Governor, then George W. Bush, issued a reprieve within a half hour of the execution. Rick McGinn spent 7 years on death row before exoneration. In another example, Dennis Williams and Ken Adams were convicted of rape and murders in Illinois. These men served 18 years on death row before their innocence was determined with post-conviction DNA testing. Finally, a review of 28 innocent convicts released because of post-conviction DNA evidence showed they spent a total of 197 years in jail. 197 unfair years in jail. These cases involved the states of Illinois, New York, Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, California, Maryland, North Carolina, Connecticut, Kansas, Ohio, Indiana, New Jersey, Texas, and the District of Columbia. Unfortunately, Oregon is not listed among those states. And that is, again, one of the intents of Senate Bill 667 is to ensure that Oregon does not join that list of states. The emphasis of post-conviction relief from DNA evidence hits the headlines when death row inmates are exonerated. However, many prisoners, including those on death row, those with life without parole sentences, and those convicted of sex crimes have found innocence or reduction in sentence through post-conviction relief involving DNA evidence. At the national level, the interest in DNA testing by those convicted of serious crimes has not led to a swarm of unwarranted testing or an overwhelming expense. And as I mentioned before, by far the largest current demand for DNA testing comes from prosecuting attorneys, not from those already convicted. So let me focus now just for a few moments on Senate Bill 667. The purpose of Senate Bill 667 is to ensure that Oregon is among those states developing laws to ensure that those convicted of serious crime have access to post-conviction relief if DNA does indeed show their evidence. The goals of Senate Bill 667 are supported by all Oregonians because none of us want innocent people executed or penalized. The use of post-conviction relief resulting from DNA evidence is not a Republican or Democrat issue, a Senate or House issue, or an issue dividing liberals and conservatives. The post-conviction DNA issue is an issue for all of us and the issue that warrants action now. And the reason we should take action now are several, but among them, let me list first, relative to other states, Oregon currently has restrictive post-conviction DNA testing guidelines. Second, techniques for analyzing DNA evidence have improved, and samples for evidence that were not adequate for DNA testing can now provide DNA evidence that can be extremely valuable. Thirdly, the federal government is developing legislation in the U.S. Senate to regulate post-conviction DNA evidence for those in federal prisons and will tie federal funding for judicial projects to states that adopt similar laws. The senators in the U.S. Senate working on this legislation include Gordon Smith from Oregon. The Senate, the U.S. Senate committee co-chairs include Senator Hatch and Senator Lehi. In addition, Senator Lehi is a former vice president of the National District Attorneys Association and is a ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Lehi's testimony to the U.S. Senate committee cites a Gallup poll that shows more than 90% of all Americans believe that DNA testing should be made available to defendants and inmates in all cases in which it has the potential to establish guilt or innocence. Senator Lehi recommends that the federal bill does not impose technical or legalistic barriers to DNA testing. My sense is that the vast majority of Oregonians agree with the Gallup poll and that they agree with the ideas expressed by the senator or by Senator Lehi. Finally, let me add that post-conviction DNA testing may save money by providing a remedy for those unnecessarily in prison. The cost of imprisonment in maximum security cells is typically $75,000 a year, with an average incarceration in a normal cell being in the order of $24,000 a year. And I might add, this is more than it costs to educate a student at Oregon State University. It's a lot of money. Money saved by freeing an innocent convict or by shortening prison time could make the program cost-effective. In addition, the moral costs of unjust imprisonments or executions are really difficult to evaluate. So to summarize, let me simply say that the intent of Senate Bill 667 is to extend the time in which DNA evidence, and only DNA evidence, could be used to seek post-conviction relief. The importance of the idea is to reduce the possibility of error in which an innocent person is either executed or unjustly convicted. DNA testing is a short, quick, definitive test that would not substantially add to the total costs of imprisonment or needless delays in justice. In fact, if DNA testing proves someone innocent, there will be ethical value as well as great financial savings. The impact of Senate Bill 667, I believe, will be a great comfort to all Oregonians. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time. Any questions from the committee? No questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Now, Brian Ostrom, do you want to come? You are from the Oregon State Police?
I am.
All right. And what would you like to share with us?
Actually, I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 920, not 667.
Well, you signed up on the wrong...
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
I'll get you signed up on that other bill. Ingrid, this will be a pleasure to hear you testify in favor of something.
Very surprising. I'm a member.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Indeed, it is a pleasure to testify in favor of this bill. I did have a chance to speak briefly with Professor Winner before he appeared today, and we are certainly appreciative of his interest in this issue and understand why a person who is a scientist would certainly support this kind of legislation. Just for the committee's information, there is another bill pending in the body. It's House Bill 2415, which is similar in nature. It has a slightly different approach, and a work group has been put together by Representative Shetterly in the House to look at this and related issues. A meeting of that group is scheduled for, actually, I think, tomorrow, and there have been several meetings to discuss the issue between defense lawyers, prosecutors, and the state police and other interested parties. But as the professor indicated, this measure would address a major gap in Oregon law, and that gap really has to do with the lack of remedies available under Oregon law for people once their conviction is final and once the period for post-conviction relief has run. Even if, after the fact, everyone is in agreement that a person is factually innocent of the crime for which they were convicted, there is no mechanism in Oregon law for undoing that conviction, for releasing that person from custody, other than through clemency and pardon power of the governor. So this would address a very specific need in Oregon. We have in the past had cases not involving DNA evidence where people have been determined to be factually innocent of murder, and yet they are serving lengthy sentences, life or somewhat less than life in a couple of those cases. And the difficulty was to find some mechanism for releasing these folks. So this bill would address that. It also obviously deals with the position that this particular form of evidence holds today in the criminal courts in this country. This is a kind of evidence which has turned out to be far more reliable than anyone would have imagined possible to be in the past. So it addresses the need for looking at convictions which occurred before that kind of evidence was available. Currently, if there are cases pending either at the trial level or at the appellate level, or if people still have post-conviction relief available to them, DNA testing is available and is being routinely used. We hope it's being used in all the cases where it should be used, but it's certainly in routine use in Oregon. But so this bill would really provide relief to a group of people, a fairly limited group of people, those people whose convictions have been final for some time. And it would allow them the option of establishing their own innocence through the use of this evidence. I provided you a couple of articles, and the professor referred to a number of studies and articles that have been written on the cases that have arisen nationally in this area. There's a good book called Actual Innocence by three attorneys, Barry Scheck, Peter Neufeld, and Jim Dwyer, who have created what is called the Innocence Project, and the purpose of that project is to seek out these cases and litigate them and, if possible, obtain relief for the falsely convicted offender. And if anyone is interested in their recommendations, I would be happy to share them. It's not really the subject matter of this bill, but they look also to the reasons why those convictions occurred, because obviously something went wrong in those trials, whether it was a defense counsel who was incompetent, whether it was an eyewitness who simply was not reliable or thought maybe thought they were reliable, but just misidentify the defendant, and they identify a number of other characteristics of our justice system which can lead to these results. But that said, we are supportive of this measure. It is a very important step to take in the state, and we're hoping that this committee will approve it.
Any questions of Ingrid? I'm just happy to hear that you can actually come in here and speak positively about one of these bills. I just think you feel...
I'd love the opportunity more often,
it
Mr.
makes sense. Ingrid's a positive person.
I know.
That would take a substantial change, though, wouldn't it? David Fidanke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon, also appearing in support of Senate Bill 667. And Mr. Chair, I guess other than what Ingrid Swenson just testified to, I wanted to just share a story, because ACLU's concern with this whole issue is that legislation to make available the possibility of post-conviction relief based on DNA testing not be too limited. And the language currently in the bill is somewhat more narrow than its drafter intends the final product to be, and indeed that is one of the issues that's being dealt with in the work group over on the House side. Because DNA evidence may bring to light evidence that may not completely exonerate a convicted defendant, but which may make it clear that the convicted defendant was not guilty of the crime for which the person was convicted. They may have been guilty of a lesser offense. Therefore, we believe it's very important that legislation such as this take that type of an outcome into account as well. And the story I wanted to share with the committee this afternoon is one that many of you may already be familiar with, was the aggravated murder conviction of two gentlemen named Boots and Proctor from Lane County. I'm more familiar with the facts relating to Chris Boots, one of the two co-defendants. In that case, it was a murder that took place of a store clerk at a 7-Eleven store in Springfield. There were no witnesses. Boots and Proctor were the two gentlemen who found the body. And very early on in the investigation, police suspicions focused on them. Even though there was someone who had been in the store earlier the evening of the murder who had seen a gentleman in the store who was very suspicious but did not fit the description of either Boots or Proctor. They were convicted, both of them, of aggravated murder. It was prior to the death penalty coming back into effect in Oregon. I believe the murder took place in 1982. They maintained their innocence throughout the proceedings. The convictions were overturned on appeal and remanded for a new trial, new sentencing proceeding. They were both reconvicted of aggravated murder. About 9 years after they had been incarcerated, the defense attorney for Mr. Boots made a motion for DNA testing in the case. One of the critical pieces of evidence was a tiny specimen of blood on the jacket that Boots had been wearing that evening. Boots maintained that it was fish blood. Testing by the State Police Crime Lab indicated it was human blood, but at the time of the trial, DNA testing was not available. The court did approve DNA testing of that blood specimen, which was very small, and the results came back from that that were inconclusive. Shortly after that, evidence came to light to the Springfield Police Department and the Lane County District Attorney's Office that there was indeed another individual who had been responsible for that murder. Another piece of evidence at the time of the trial, the victim's hands had been bound with masking tape. And when police uncovered the masking tape, they found a fingerprint, a thumbprint, on the masking tape, which did not match either of the two defendants in the case. That is, didn't match either Boots or Proctor. Police began to focus in on this third suspect, were on their way to interview him when he committed suicide. He had earlier confessed to a cousin who was the one who had gone to the police. After that suspect's death, they ran his fingerprint, compared it to the thumbprint on the masking tape at the time of the murder, and it matched. Boots and Proctor were released from prison, eventually filed a civil suit, and that case was settled. And the reason I'm sharing this story is that I wanted to be very clear that while DNA evidence is important and can solve many crimes, it cannot solve all crimes. The technology is advancing very quickly. It is critical to maintain evidence that might contain DNA information. We believe as long as a person is incarcerated, because the technology is advancing so quickly, there may be tests that are done today, tests that are done 5 years from now, that may not provide conclusive evidence one way or the other. But technology available 10 years from now or 20 years from now may indeed exonerate some people that have been imprisoned for a very, very long time. And I would hope that as the committee deals with this issue, you will try to keep those possibilities in mind. Thank you,
Senator Courtney.
You just answered your question. I assume everything you said in terms of maintaining evidence, that's not in the bill. So
it's
you're asking to be added to the bill.
It is one of the issues that's being discussed in the work group on the other side. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. David, thank you. And it is a pleasure to have you testify in favor of something, too. And this is your first appearance, although we've had one of your friends here yesterday. So. All right, thank you. We will conclude then the public hearing on Senate Bill 667. Council, you want to kind of give the committee an update on what's going on with the House bill, 2415, just so that they're aware.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a work group on House Bill 2415. I have had a discussion with Representative Shetterly, who indicates that from his understanding is the work group is quite close to resolving the terms of the bill. I think one of the things that's being discussed is that rather than a post-conviction relief petition, that this might be handled as a motion for a new trial. Post-conviction relief is typically reserved for incompetence of counsel as opposed to something like this, which in most cases may be new technology that didn't exist and things that weren't possible. Senator Shetterly is, Representative Shetterly is willing to, have any members of this group work jointly on the bill, but it appears that the work group is quite close to a final version on 2415.
So the chair's intent would be to wait for 2415 to get over here and have the product of the work group in front of us, but at the same time we've got this bill introduced as a request of Mr. Winter, and so one of the things I'm hoping to do, I believe I'm right, if the Secretary of the Senate hears something come out of my mouth that isn't correct in terms of the rules, she can come up and admonish me, but I believe that we can request additional requesters and sponsors of the bill when the bill comes to the House. So my hope is that we can accommodate the fact that Mr. Winter was also a, I guess, a simultaneous discoverer of this, this kind of a concept, if you will, so that you can be included with some credit to the movement in this area of law. Yes, no?
As I understand it, because the House bill was pre-session filed, there can't be the addition of any sponsors on the House side. It's possible that there could be an addition of sponsors on the Senate side.
I think with the suspension of the rules, we can pretty much do whatever we want. But
we're certainly willing to investigate that, and I know that Representative Shetterly did indicate that Mr. Winter would be welcome to work with the work group that he's assembled.
Okay. Mr. Winter, hopefully that's accommodating to you. Senator Courtney.
Just a ways and means question. I'd hope that the state police would come up and put some things in the record. It's my understanding, Mr. Chair, and you know this better than anybody, that I've only visited the Springfield and the Portland forensic labs. It's my understanding only in Portland do they have the equipment to do DNA testing. Is that correct?
I don't know that for sure. We do have somebody from OSP here.
He may not know because he's...
Well, I think he does. He's shaking his head.
He's here.
Well,
we'll get into that a little bit deeper in Central 920, which also deals with DNA, but it's kind of on the other side of
okay.
the question of DNA. So that's okay. We'll close then the public hearing on Senate Bill 667. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 920. And just for the committee, kind of give you the background and the origin of this bill. This bill is sponsored by yours truly, Senator Deckert Metzger, and my beloved spouse, Representative Nunn. It's interesting. The origin of the bill is such that sitting around with some of my detective friends in the Portland Police Bureau, one of the folks working sex crimes, has worked sex crimes for the last 16 years, said just kind of casually to me that, you know, John, if we had DNA samples from property crimes offenders, there's a strong belief that there's a correlation or that we would find individuals who are responsible for some of the sex crimes that we're currently investigating. Where in sex crimes, we tend to get trace evidence. We tend to have some kind of DNA sample left behind normally. And so I introduced the bill and then met with a gentleman by the name of Ed Zedaleski, who's with the Institute for Law and Justice in the Department of Justice back in Washington, D.C., when he was out, and he said, it just so happens that there is a significant correlation in some states. There are 7 states that currently have the collection of DNA evidence for all felons. What they're finding is they're running various trace evidence against those newly collected samples. They're finding that some persons previously believed only to be property crimes offenders are, in fact, connected to homicides and so on and so forth. So this bill really kind of deals with the collection of DNA evidence for the purpose of law enforcement and prosecution having the ability to have something to screen the trace evidence against. So with 667, you have the ability to order a new trial based on DNA evidence for the purpose of protecting, I guess, the person falsely or wrongly convicted. In this case, we want to identify the person who's actually responsible and prosecute those folks, hopefully up front. There are 18 states, according to counsel, that have introduced similar legislation in the United States, and we're going to begin with a radio broadcast that was published 3/8 of this year with the National Public Radio, NPR.
National Public Radio.
So we're going to listen to that, hear what they have to say about this concept, and then we'll get into the negative testimony.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Paul Duckworth. DNA is best known for proving the innocence of people who have been wrongly convicted and getting them out of prison. A quieter, more profound revolution is happening at the crime scene, where investigators are gathering evidence and developing their suspects. Virginia leads the nation with 140,000 criminal profiles in its DNA databank. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
It was her first night back in Charlottesville. The senior at the University of Virginia, who asked not to be identified, fell asleep, but was awakened by someone moving around in her room. She reached out and felt the barrel of a gun. "Where is your wallet?" the man said.
I was so flustered at that point, I had no idea where I'd put my wallet. I was like, it's either on the floor of my bedroom or in my car. And he said, well, how much do you have in it? And I said, I only have $5. And he said, well, that's not enough. You're going to pay.
That was when he raped her. He made her take a shower and walked her down to the kitchen where he drank a beer. All the time, she was blindfolded.
I saw an outline of him. Like, I could tell that he was about 5'10", fat, African-American male, you know, mid-20s. That's about all I could tell. And so I never, couldn't have never picked him out of a lineup, ever.
Charlottesville police developed a list of about 40 suspects, but quickly ruled them out. A few weeks later, Lieutenant Chip Harvey, who is the chief of investigations, got a phone call from the Virginia Department of Forensic Science. They were testing semen from the girl's sheets and saliva from the beer can. The DNA profile matched one in the state data bank.
And I can remember getting a call from forensic scientists in Richmond, and it's emotional now even talking about it. But dropping the phone and just jumping up and down going, my God, I can't believe this. We know who did this to her.
It turned out that the man had a criminal record, not for sexual assault, but for gang-related violence. But since Virginia takes DNA samples from every convicted felon, his name and social security number popped up. The man was convicted. This kind of result has radically changed the way police work in Charlottesville, Virginia. Sergeant Ralph Barfield, who heads up forensic investigations, is almost breathless with examples. The rapist who blew out a candle before attacking his victim, the candle had his saliva. The burglar who wore a pair of socks on his hands left no fingerprints, but the discarded socks contained his skin cells. They found a bank robber who dropped his ski mask and identified a murderer from the sweat in his baseball cap. Barfield says it's nothing like the old days.
You know, you had to have a half-dollar size amount of blood just to get a blood type. Now, oh, it's so nice now. Now I don't have to have blood at all. You know, you drink from your coffee cup. I know how to handle your coffee cup. I got your DNA. You and I shake hands. I know how to handle it. I've got your DNA. As long as I know how to do my part, collecting and the packaging and storing and transporting to prevent the cross-contamination, I got you. I got you.
Barfield says another beauty of DNA is that it never grows old. In that sense, he says it's a better witness than people whose memories fade over time.
This one is referred to as the archive room. And whenever it goes into this room are cases on appeal, unsolved cases.
The room is the size of a garage and stacked to the ceiling with evidence kits from unsolved murders and rapes 5, 10, 15 years old. Barfield points to a rape kit.
And sooner or later with the databank, his blood's going to show up in that databank, and we'll come back for him.
Virginia has by far the largest databank of all the states, and now it's paying off not just in solving crimes, but in preventing them. The reason is the link between property crimes and rape.
Negative 131. I need you to start towards 810 Harris Street, Southern States, for a phone and alarm. Showing general burglar. I'll get you another unit.
It's only breaking and entering, but Barfield sends a forensic detective to the crime scene anyway. The trailer home door has been kicked in. DVD is missing. There's no broken glass, no blood, no fingerprints, no DNA. But Barfield says they always sent a forensic detective, because if the burglar had left his DNA, he could easily show up as a rapist.
Another thing we've learned is that guys that start out doing burglary, they're just a thief, they're just breaking into your house to steal your stereo, but lo and behold, your wife, your daughter, your girlfriend happens to be there, and they stumble into them, and it becomes a crime of opportunity, and they go, oh, well. What we found is so many of the burglars are going from burglary, they move up to rape.
Paul Ferrara says that's borne out by statistics. Ferrara is the director of Virginia's Department of Forensic Science and the man credited with putting Virginia on a scientific fast track. Ferrara says more than half the rapists they've caught were already in the data bank, not for sexual assault, but for burglary. He says that's why Virginia takes the DNA of all felons. If you don't, he says, you give someone a free rape. But Ferrara says there's a problem. Most states are just beginning to create their own data bank, so all someone has to do to elude detection is leave Virginia.
Somebody who's finds themselves in our DNA data bank may be well inclined to take his criminal activities to some other state, thinking that, well, I got to get out of Virginia because, you know, I'm forever in that data bank, and I move or do anything and I'm going to get mail, so I'll go to a neighboring state or I'll go out to the West Coast.
Several states have no data bank at all. Many are just getting going. Christopher Esplin, who heads the National Commission on the Future of DNA, says there are more than a million violent offenders who should be in a DNA data bank, but aren't, because of cost.
One example is we know that we have in excess of 180,000 rape kits across the country, which should be DNA tested, and those profiles should be put in the database, but have not. Essentially, what you have is a very powerful technology, a very powerful database that just doesn't have enough data in it.
Congress passed a bill to give states $170 million, but that money wasn't included in the budget. So Virginia is forging ahead on its own.
What you're seeing right now is you're seeing laboratory tables where the examiners are working. They're looking at evidence from criminal cases, looking for things like blood.
Lisa Schiermeyer at the Virginia Department of Forensic Science shows off a roomy new laboratory. She says just getting a usable sample can take a month. It's then mathematically translated into what looks like a barcode and entered into the data bank.
When you find that needle in a haystack, it's a good day. It's an even better day when that needle hits on a convicted felon in the data bank. You're suddenly the one providing investigative information to the police, and that's a really good feeling.
The computer searches two sets of data banks. One has the DNA of all convicted felons in Virginia. The other includes DNA from all unsolved crimes. Just before 4 p.m., Shelley Smith positions herself in front of the computer.
When I received the case, the information that I received was that the victim had been drugged by an unknown individual and then raped.
There's no suspect in the case, since the woman never saw the perpetrator. And so the data bank is, for now, their only hope.
What is going on?
Smith enters the information. We wait for several long seconds. I ask how long this generally takes.
Generally, oh my. I gotta get.
The DNA matches the profile of a convicted felon. It will be double checked before Smith calls up the detective who submitted the DNA. This is really only the beginning of the case. Police have to track down the man and build a case against him. But all in all, a one-in-a-billion match is a pretty good place to start. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Charlottesville, Virginia.
Thank you. So with that, it seems to me that there's at least a compelling reason to look at the collection of this kind of information. I think one of the things we're going to run up against, probably here from OSP, is just the cost of collection of this kind of data and information. It is fairly expensive when you start expanding the universe. Did you have any comments you want to make? No? Okay. Brian, do you want to come up and share with us OSP's perspective? and by the way, just kind of an aside as Brian's coming up, I had a case about 6 years ago when I was working child sexual abuse cases where I had one semen head found in the underwear of a five-year-old girl. And at that time, the OSP crime lab could not break that down to identify the suspect. They could not get DNA from that one sperm head. Today they can do that, I think even a fraction of one sperm head. But it's expanded so rapidly that it's actually blown people's minds in terms of what we can do and who we can identify and so on and so forth. So, Brian, hit it.
Yeah, thank you. Chairman and members of the community, for the record, my name is Brian Ostrom. I am the supervisor of the Oregon State Police DNA program located in the Portland Laboratory. I am responsible to oversee all forensic DNA casework that is performed for Oregon's criminal justice community, as well as manage the convicted offender database called CODIS. I appreciate this opportunity to appear before you today and testify in support of Senate Bill 920. This legislation is the logical next step to ensure Oregonians have the availability of this extremely effective tool in solving crime. As you are well aware, the 1991 legislature approved the Oregon State Police to collect DNA samples from persons convicted of specific crimes involving murder and sex offense. As a result of that 1991 legislation, Oregon was not only approved to develop a DNA database, but also became a participant in a national program known as CODIS, Combined DNA Indexing System. CODIS established national standards for DNA database development and management. It also provided an electronic link for the searching of all states' databases. The 1999 legislature expanded the crimes for DNA collection to include burglary one and assault one. Senate Bill 920 takes a logical step to include all felony convictions in our database. The databases of all felony crimes currently exist in Alabama, Georgia, New Mexico, New York, Tennessee, Virginia, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. Numerous other states, including Washington, are considering this expansion. Oregon's convicted offender database currently contains just over 17,000 individuals. To date, we have made 35 hits, either linking cases together or identifying specific individuals. While I'm extremely proud of our success, it's only a fraction of what could have occurred had we collected samples from all convicted felons. As an example, Virginia has more than 140,000 convicted offenders in its DNA database and has made more than 260 hits to date. Of those, 150 occurred in 2000 alone. They report that 85% of these hits would not have occurred if their database had been limited to conviction for violent offenses. Other states with all felony databases, like Virginia, are experiencing similar results. A high percentage of their DNA hits involve past convictions for property crimes. They're finding that a rape, an assault, or even a murder becomes a crime of opportunity when the burglar or thief was interrupted during the commission of a property crime. Unfortunately, Senate Bill 2920 does not involve a fiscal impact, and it would require laboratory staff to process and input an additional 11,000 convicted offenders into our DNA base annually. This would involve a substantial increase over our current annual volume of approximately 4,000 convicted felons. Our complete fiscal impact has been submitted to the legislative fiscal. That concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Senator Brady.
Regarding the fiscal, have you made any attempt to factor in the reduced investigation time that might be involved if you had a quick access to DNA matches?
I don't have that information, no. No.
But would you anticipate, you know, being from law enforcement, that there would be a reduced investigation time?
Sure, I would. An unsolved rape case comes in, I profile, search a database, and tell them, here's the person's SID and name. I think that substantially could reduce the amount of time taken to investigate a case.
Thank you. Anyone else? Questions, Senator Barr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I guess, may point more toward the last bill, 667, but I'm just curious how you can use DNA samples to prove a negative.
On this case, what you would do is you would profile some rape evidence compared to the database. If there is no evidence from a rape, obviously there is nothing to compare. So it only if there was some type of physical evidence left to profile.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Could I guess, as I said, in the case of 667, let's say in some of these cases where people convicted of murder have been released because of DNA testing, and I'm just curious how you can use DNA to prove someone didn't commit a crime. I mean, just because there is no DNA there doesn't mean they didn't commit the crime. It just means they may not have left DNA there. So I'm curious to know how you can use DNA testing to prove a negative.
Well, I guess, for example, let's say you have a homicide that takes place and you find out that when you do the testing of the vaginal swab that actually it does not match the suspect they thought they did the rape. If that answers your question. If there is no DNA evidence to test, I mean, there has to be something to test in order to come up with an answer. So you have to have something available to profile, to compare against a suspect or a victim or a database.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm just curious to know how they use DNA to prove some of these people who we heard stories about in the last bill, how they could use DNA evidence to prove they didn't commit a crime. And
right. Well, actually, we might have Ingrid come up. She might have some ideas. But I think part of the answer is kind of under the totality of the circumstances. And each case is fairly, you know, significant. You have to look at them case by case because you may, I mean, you could have a case where you have one party who was present. Their DNA may very well be there, but they didn't, in fact, commit the murder. But it may be part of a story that they told or an alibi that they gave. The other two or one persons who that person claims is responsible aren't around or haven't been available for interview or whatever else. And what's happening, though, right now is the DNA science is advancing so quickly that things that we couldn't do 5 years ago, we can do today. And so the DNA evidence becomes more significant. Ingrid, do you have an example of how this might work? I mean, I think that, and that's why it becomes a request for a new trial, because I think the court has to look at it, and then the totality of the circumstances is what's being presented sufficient to show or demonstrate that this particular defendant who was previously convicted is, in fact, not the right person.
Mr. Chair and members and Senator Barr, yeah, just because someone's DNA sample is not present doesn't establish their innocence, because obviously they could have been there and left no DNA, or they could have participated and left no DNA. So it depends entirely on the exact circumstances of the case. For example, if there were a rape case in which the victim said she had not had sexual contact for a month, except with the perpetrator, and there was one perpetrator and only one, and if there's evidence of semen or something that can be tested and it identifies a specific individual and none other, then that testimony, all of the evidence in the case is consistent with there being one person who did it, and if it's not the defendant, in those kinds of circumstances, you can establish it. But there are lots of cases where it doesn't eliminate someone from suspicion.
Any other comments?
Right. No, yeah, that's exactly it.
Senator Courtney?
There is only one DNA lab in Oregon, is that correct?
Correct. We have centralized it in the Portland Laboratory, which is in the Justice Center.
But how long does it take you to run DNA?
Currently, the process we're doing is called, the technique called short tandem repeat. It takes about, our turnaround time right now is about 50 days. That's how long it takes to process it. We can do it a lot quicker if we don't have other cases pending. I mean, it can be done as quickly as a few weeks, the process.
We're going to get copies, by the way, of the fiscal that was done. And you said earlier it was 11,000 persons per year. That would be on average each year. Is that correct?
Correct.
Part of the fiscal will also demonstrate there's kind of a ramp up.
Right. In the first biennium, we have the people that are currently in jail or incarceration that we would need to collect. And that's why the first biennium has more of a fiscal impact than years, than that year, or biennium is after that.
All right. And so we're going to try to work. And then the other thing that was brought up in a previous meeting I had, the cost of doing DNA sampling and analysis, is it going up? Is it staying stable? Is it going down?
I think it'll go down. It's going down. I mean, as laboratories get more set up and you get more production line, there's a lot of forensic talk right now on trying to streamline the process, getting better of equipment, better software.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And now for an opposing opinion, or several. Ingrid?
So soon I'm back to my usual role.
Oh, you're back here.
Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We do oppose this bill. I understand the appeal of having available DNA from probably everybody in some senses, not just convicted felons. It would certainly make police work easier. However, identifying information from people is an intrusion. It's also a search. And while the courts have determined that this type of search and seizure can be justified by a reasonable need for the information, I'm fairly certain that they would not approve requiring ordinary citizens who aren't convicted of any crimes to submit their DNA, even though that would be a very helpful investigative tool, because that's just the the balance in that case would weigh on the side of the individual liberty as against the need for police evidence. The original DNA bill, of course, included just sex offenders. Last session, the legislature added burglary in the first degree and assault in the first degree. And the testimony that the legislature heard last session was that it was important to add these two offenses specifically because there was a high correlation between people who committed those particular offenses and sex offenders. And based on that testimony, the legislature approved that addition last session. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has looked at Oregon's original DNA gathering measure and upheld that against a constitutional challenge. But, and this is the case of RISE versus the State of Oregon, 59 Federal 3rd, 1556, decided in 1995. And there the defendant challenged this DNA specimen requirement on the ground that it was an unlawful search and seizure. The court found that indeed it was a search and it was a seizure, but in balancing all of the factors involved at that point, they determined that this was a reasonable interference with the defendant's right, constitutional right, against search and seizure. And they, among the reasons that they included in their opinion was that the particular crimes involved were likely to involve evidence from which DNA information could be derived, and they are crimes that had high rates of recidivism. So part of the information which they considered in upholding this scheme was that it wasn't every offense for which DNA testing was required. It was certain offenses that had been looked at for a couple of criteria, one of which was, does DNA evidence often exist in these cases? And secondly, is there a high recidivism rate? If you were to expand DNA testing to include basically any offense, it might not withstand constitutional challenge in the Ninth Circuit. The court specifically talked about blood tests in that case. Currently, the state police and other agencies use either blood testing or buccal sample testing, which is to remove superficial tissue sample from the inside of the mouth. The case law hasn't really distinguished those two as far as I know. I mean, they might have. But one is obviously much less intrusive than the other, and blood sampling involves the removal of a blood sample from the person whose sample is being taken. It also has some additional concerns, and that is that there is a actual sample of blood around which is yours. And at least in some defendants' minds, that specimen, it could be mishandled. And that blood could show up on evidence where it never was before. And there are proprietary interests in that blood sample and other things which make it something different from a buccal sample. It's my understanding that a buccal sample isn't able to be misapplied because it's a sample that would basically deteriorate and not be usable. You couldn't transfer the DNA from that sample to some piece of evidence, and there is no quantity of the DNA that you could use for proprietary purposes or something else. So I think there is a significant difference there. Interestingly, Wisconsin requires only buccal testing. It does not require a person to submit to blood testing. I think that's an important consideration if you're looking at expanding the submission of samples in this state. There's some reason to think that requiring the buccal sampling only might be less intrusive and that the balance would be weighed differently because of that. When you think about all the felonies that there are, so many of them, involve, particularly property crimes, involve so little likelihood that there's going to be DNA evidence found in connection with those, that it
which ones are you thinking of?
Well, I was thinking of UUVs, for example.
You think you could find DNA evidence in a car stolen by someone?
Well, you could, but you can find fingerprint evidence now, and it's almost never used.
Okay.
Can
you tell me what the scientific background is that supports fingerprints as a tool to identify individual?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I don't understand the scientific background.
Well, part of the information that I gathered from Mr. Zadaleski from the Department of Justice was that there's a current court challenge to the use of fingerprints for the purpose of identification, because there is virtually no scientific background that supports the use of fingerprints for the purpose of individual identification. It's currently federal case that the courts are going to be deciding.
Mr. Chair, I have to tell you I'm stunned to hear that, because that's contrary to everything I've ever heard about fingerprint evidence, which is that everybody's prints are unique. Right now, hair samples, for example, don't enjoy the same, I mean, if there's DNA involved, but for some time people have compared hair samples, and that's, I don't think, considered good science. But I had not heard that there was a serious challenge to the reliability of fingerprint evidence.
Right.
But in any case,
right,
in most property crimes, fingerprint evidence is there, has been there for years, and it's routinely ignored. It's just not a comparison that's done. There are lots of other property offenses, I think, for which the same is true. So there's no significant correlation, is all I'm saying, between the ordinary unauthorized use of a motor vehicle offender and comparing him with a data bank of sex offenders or looking for a suspect.
So are you suggesting that date rapes don't occur in cars or couldn't occur in stolen cars?
Mr. Chair, certainly not, but I'm saying the correlation is probably so low that it doesn't warrant the DNA testing of every single felon.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Ingrid. All right. The next view in opposition, Mr. Fidanke. Again, welcome. You'll probably feel
Thank
more
you,
comfortable
Mr. Chair.
In this role.
Again, for the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. I don't have too much to add to what Ingrid has just testified to. ACLU did testify back in 1991 when the original bill was pending before this body, and our concern was twofold. One, the issue of the search and seizure issue that Ms. Swenson referred to. The other issue was the possibility that this database might be used for other purposes, and that once the database was in place, the temptation would be to expand it further and further and further. We have indeed seen that expansion of the use of the fingerprint database in recent years, which originally was gathered solely for the purpose of criminal investigations. We would hope that, while we do not support the expansion of this particular database at this time to all felonies, we would hope that if the committee goes down that road, that you would also impose very strict limitations on the purposes for which this database could be used. Because I think most Oregonians, on the one hand, would feel very strongly that we should be taking appropriate steps to identify criminals and to separate guilty suspects from innocent suspects as early on in the process as possible. I think most Oregonians would also be greatly alarmed if this legislature were opening the door to a broad-scale database that included DNA, or at some time that might be expanded to include DNA samples from citizens who have not committed crimes or citizens whose convictions have been set aside and other such situations.
Right. And actually, David, I think the admonition's a good one. I think I didn't bring copies of it, but in today's paper, Germany is actually considering trying to get DNA samples from every male person living within the country. So I think David raises a good point. I think it's a good admonition.
Okay.
And it's kind of a timely article, but it does show you that, you know, that you could go to that illogical conclusion where you're including people who have not had a criminal conviction for anything. You're just assuming that because males are responsible for only about 98% of all sex crimes, that somehow...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Somehow you would draw the conclusion that it's necessary.
Don't leave it.
So it's an interesting point.
I got a question, so he's going to come back up.
You can't just leave that early until the chair tells you it's okay.
I'm sorry.
David, I just had a question on that same line. You mentioned that you didn't want to see this expanding, such as the database has been used for fingerprinting. Could you just enlighten me on some of the ways in which that has been expanded, the use of the fingerprint database?
Well, pending in this session, but the check on the use of fingerprints in the past has been that the National Fingerprint Database is kept by the FBI. Under federal law, they are only permitted to perform fingerprint match analysis on behalf of law enforcement agencies. So beginning about 10 years ago, because the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission wanted to be sure that teaching applicants did not have convictions of sex offenses outside the state of Oregon when they were applying for licenses here, the legislature authorized Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to be a law enforcement agency for the purposes of requesting fingerprint analysis from the FBI. It goes through the state police, back to the FBI. The fingerprints are returned, the actual prints from the applicant are returned to Oregon and destroyed if there is no match found. And that was a provision that we insisted on at the time. So that because we were concerned that the FBI at some point might decide there should be fingerprint database of all adults in the U.S. FBI hasn't been interested in that, hasn't had the resources to be able to do it. But the FBI has gotten so swamped with these kinds of requests because they've been expanded to include all workers who have access to children, child care workers, and other agencies. There's a bill pending over in the House Judiciary Committee right now that would expand it to nonprofit agencies whose employees have access to children. So the tendency, not just in Oregon, but across the country, has been to expand the use of fingerprints at the time an applicant applies for a job or at the time they're certified by the state to ensure they don't have any outstanding convictions for offenses that might, for which they might pose a danger to the clients that they are going to be dealing with. And that's understandable. The FBI has been so swamped by these kinds of requests that they are now trying to set up a separate agency to do these fingerprint checks. our concern is that, you know, it's an easy step from there to keeping everyone's fingerprints. And we're adamantly opposed to that. Likewise here, while the law enforcement purpose is, we think, has the best of intentions, our concern is that DNA, material that includes DNA information regarding individuals, contains all kinds of information about individuals, not just their identity. And we want to be sure that whatever DNA samples are kept by the government are used for very limited, discrete purposes and are collected from as small a group of individuals as possible. In our view, the government should have a pretty steep hill to climb before it can keep that type of database that has such intimate information regarding a person, not just the individual, but their ancestors as well.
All right. Was your question to David today? Just a general question.
Probably a question for you. On the information you handed out about the fiscal, I guess my question was, or is, why would we need to test all people who were in DOC at one time? It seems like we could test them upon release.
Right. In fact, Senator, that's a good point. That question was raised in the meeting that I had with OSB. But they would, the question was that it gives them some time. Do you recall the answer? I try to remember.
Well, one of the things that we talked about is perhaps for the catch-up folks would be just testing them on release.
Right. But they felt that as they're in the institution, if they had the opportunity while they're there, that they would give them some time to go ahead and do that. Frankly, I'm for any possibility of reducing the cost, because I don't think this legislature is going to spend $2 million to do this. Senator Harper.
Earlier, Mr. Chair, talked about some federal grant. Have you heard any discussion on that? The reason for the question is in a position to put a placeholder bill out there just so we have it with one buck to
I think what it said in the program was, though, that was a proposal, but it wasn't included in the president's budget. I don't think that was passed. I do know that I believe that there's – oh, no, that's the other bill. Never mind.
I think one of the things I want to go back to with David, I think David Finanke brings kind of an interesting and I think an appropriate admonition. You know, this committee heard the Interstate Compact dealing with – you know, the information sharing, it was on the schedule yesterday. When we first heard it, I think most of the committee objected to the sharing of arrest information for the various purposes. And, you know, for that reason, I don't sense that there's support in this committee to move that thing forward. So I think it's appropriate for the legislature to look at the purposes for which certain information is going to be provided. We have to understand if with the compact issue, there may be some fiscal impact we're going to suffer on the other side. They're going to charge us another 50% of the actual cost of running fingerprints against their database if we don't comply. But we'll just leave that up to, you know, a future legislature. I guess we'll stick them with it.
Mr. Chair, another thing, possibility, you know, there could be some positive revenue things as a result of this, because the testimony was that they could really reduce investigative time. And so we might have state, county, city departments, you know, cutting back on their detective forces, for example, because, you know,
I think there is some truth to that, and I think one of the things you don't like to do in investigations is spin your wheels. I think any detective who deals with serious violent crimes loves to have forensic evidence, and if you have forensic evidence and you can match it against a viable suspect, that's like a dream come true. As opposed to interviewing umpty zillion people until you finally come up with, you know, a possible suspect and then continue with the investigation, kind of the old Jack Webb approach that we were engaged in. On Senate Bill 114, by the way, we do have the genetic privacy bill in front of this committee, which we're going to have some subsequent hearings on, too, and the issue of the exception for criminal investigations.
Mm-hmm.
Comes up in that too, so we do want to make sure.
But Mr. Chen, you know, that's a very valid point. When David was talking about that, that's what I was thinking of in terms of, you know, some of these other things that we're dealing with. For example, I don't know what it is now, but let's say you got this huge database, and then say OHSU wants to do a genetic testing of people who are in the penal system. I wonder how many of these people, you know, have diabetic, you know, genetic connections or something like this, and all of a sudden you start getting these linkages for other things that get out, you know, while we're passing other legislation trying to prevent that, and all of a sudden these things happen. I mean, it's just something to the interlocking of some of these issues is critical.
Thank you, remarks about 93 really hit me hard. I had you were trying to roll together to get the background check. So, the issue of destruction of the fingerprints became, I think, the final issue for us, if we worked so hard on that bill. That was critical, getting that bill through and getting it passed. And you bring up Germany. This issue of Ingrid talks about Wisconsin is only allowing a certain kind of this DNA to be used. We really are about something very serious here, very, very serious about this. The genetic privacy bill, it's all together. And it's almost frightening in a way. I listened to the tape, and the individual was euphoric over how easy it is and how wonderful it is. But on the other hand, there is potential here for incredible danger and misuse that I just hope that we're really going to, you know, reach down. The best of us, our abilities are going to come together on this if we're going to do it, to protect as well as to allow use of it in a very positive way. Because it's, this is all good stuff. I mean, this is, I'm really challenged by it, John.
Well, I agree with you. I think it is fairly significant in just the technology, and the explosion of the technology makes things, again, that weren't possible 5 years ago, possible today. And I think when you get involved in the stewardship of those things, it is very, very important that we construct it correctly. Now, Juvenile Rights Project, another third voice against this, and then hopefully close with Mr. Penn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Osborne. I'm a senior attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project. Senate Bill 920 would also affect juveniles. Right now in ORS 419C.4473, it requires blood and buccal samples being taken of juveniles that would be adjudicated on crimes that are listed in 137.706, since we're amending 137.076, since we're amending that would also sweep juveniles up into the individuals who would be additional testing. I don't know whether the OSP took the additional juveniles into account in their fiscal, but that would be additional people. In addition, let's take the unauthorized use of a motor vehicle that Ingrid mentioned earlier. Let's say a 14-year-old took their parents' car, which is an unauthorized use of motor vehicle. The parents trying to teach this youth a lesson want this youth adjudicated in juvenile court because it's not the first time that the child has taken the parents' car and they're kind of sick of it and want to teach him a lesson. That would require this bill, Senate Bill 920, would require that the use blood and or buccal samples would be taken. If that, when that youth turns 18, those records do not go away. They keep forever the blood and buccal samples. If it's an expungible offense and the youth moves to expunge his or her record, even the expungement of his or her record does not destroy the blood or buccal sample or the DNA sample that's kept. That would be kept for essentially forever, and that youth would be listed in the OSP crime DNA labs for essentially have taken his parents' car at 14 years old. So when this individual is then 50 years old, his DNA sample is still in with the Oregon State Police. The other thing I want to mention is when you listen to the radio count, what the person was talking about is, I know how to do this, and but for cross-contamination. And cross-contamination is a problem with DNA. It wouldn't be a problem when the sample is being taken from the individual, but it is a problem when samples are being taken from the crime scenes. So this 14-year-old is now, let's say, 50 years old, and because of cross-contamination or some other degradation of the DNA, comes up as a hit as committing a crime. Now, I don't think I want to be that 50-year-old who did not commit a crime, having to go through the expense of having to hire a defense attorney and prove that the scientific evidence that was taken when he was 14 there's something wrong with it. That's essentially, instead of having to prove your guilty, you're almost putting that 50-year-old in the position of having to prove their innocence because of some cross-contamination that could have occurred. That Juvenile Rights Project is opposed to this because of the addition of juveniles and because we like to think that our juvenile system does a very good job. When we are listing the felonies, the sex crimes, or even adding the assault one or the burglaries charges, the state police were able to bring in, they did a whole dog and pony show last session showing us the correlation between convictions or even juvenile adjudications on those offenses and subsequent sex crimes or serious assault or murders. They were able to bring in the correlation that showed that, you know, this is how high the strike is. They're not able to show us that information for unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. And that's where I think we're taking the step what Dave Fedanke was warning us about. I'm available for questions.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none. Dale?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney. The District Attorney's Association does support this bill. When I became a lawyer in Oregon, I realized that I was fingerprinted, and I think Mr. Fedanke supported that legislation for lawyers to be fingerprinted. Maybe not. Maybe I was wrong. But we support this bill for the reasons you have heard as far as discussions that it is very helpful in investigation to be able to narrow a focus and not to be bothering or investigative innocent people, but focusing on the guilty people. This bill does focus on people who have been convicted of crimes or adjudicated on the crime, and presently we take fingerprints and photographs of people who have been arrested for crimes. A buccal swab is basically a cotton swab run through your mouth. It's very simple procedure, and in practical terms, that's what this is all about, after conviction, running a cotton swab through someone's mouth. And then that information being available to compare in future crimes or investigations so that if they were not involved in identification in that crime, they would not be harassed. But for all of those reasons, we support it. I think there are some ways to phase this in. We supported legislation on the House side, which was just an effort to add a few crimes to this, but we do believe taking a step to pull all felonies in is a wise step. Perhaps there are ways we can do it in a fiscally responsible way. Thank you.
All right, Dale. Thank you, Senator.
And that's the process. Just a swab, that's all it takes, and it gets everything you need.
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, yes, it does allow for blood because that was the original method, but then we amended the law two or three sessions ago to allow for buccal swabs, which is basically the cotton swab, and that is in practical terms the way it is done.
I actually used to say 5 years ago, you used to have to get two purple stoppers of blood, and you know, yeah. There were certain procedures you had to handle, how the blood was transported, and it was kept in the refrigerator, and blah, blah, blah. Now you just get a couple of swabs, you air dry them, put them in a little paper bag, and seal it, and turn it over to those crime labs. So, pretty simple. Any other questions, comments, anybody out there that feels like they would like to chat about this? Senator Portman?
I just want to ask Dave Fedanke, not to put you in a spot, but if you had your druthers, this bill in any form would go away. Is that where you, how you feel about this? For a very serious reason, I'm asking this, Mr. Fedanke. I mean, I'm not trying to joke or flip as I asked you that question.
Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, the easiest thing for me would be if it just went away, but I don't think, I mean, the genie is out of the bottle. And I think the issue for the legislature is to try to anticipate where are we liable to be headed down this road. And let's, I mean, it would have been our preference back in 1991 for the legislature to have set some strict limitations on how these DNA samples could be used, how they would be maintained, we think that at each step along the road that this database is expanded, those questions and issues are going to get more difficult to deal with. Right now, it's essentially left to the goodwill and best intentions of the State Police Crime Lab to determine the purposes for which these samples are going to be used. And we would like to see a lot more forethought concerning, I mean, the kinds of issues that you were talking about earlier, Senator.
Back to 91, but isn't it also true that, let's say we didn't do anything in 91, you still have the science, the DNA, that whole thing that's out there as well. It's like this genetic privacy bill that we're struggling with, you know. We have to, that's out there. So let's, please include that in the genie. It isn't, I think that should also hopefully be part of your discussion. That's why I asked the question. You can say the easiest thing is, even if this bill goes away, it's still not easy.
That's right.
It's still not easy stuff. And I think that's what I hope becomes part of this discussion. I mean that in a very profound way, David, because it's easy to say, to be frank with you, I'm for or I'm against it. I mean, that's really the easy. The hard thing is, what do you do with the science, and what do you do with where we're at as lawmakers, ACLU, to create the standards that you say we missed on 91. I like to think we didn't miss on 93. You didn't say that, but in a way you're sort of saying that, if you know what I mean by 93.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if you understand me, reference it. And that's all I'm trying to get here, is that kind of dialogue going on and thinking. And but maybe you got to go ahead. You want to shut us down.
Yeah, I need to do that, but I need to take a motion to suspend the rules to allow several members to vote on the Senate.
I've had my statements.
But
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your sentiments, Senator. I agree with them entirely.
I'm going to close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 920, and either of the senators want to move to suspend the rule. I'll move to suspend the rules to allow me to vote on Senate Bill 925. All right. Senator Metzger moves to suspend the rules to allow both himself and Senator Burdick to vote on Senate Bill 925, and their votes will not change the outcome, if I understand correctly. Any objection to suspending the rules? Senator Burdick, how do you vote? Senator Burdick votes yes. Senator Metzger, how do you vote? Aye. Senator Metzger votes aye. 925. And thank you all for your testimony. We appreciate it. We're adjourned.
In the sex offender notification, this is an area where I hope we're going to stay on. I mean, Pink Fidanky's right.
Yes.